If you like Academic Agents content on this channel, sign up for a course on the Academic Agency. He's now offering Foundations of Economics. Click the link in the show description and level up your econ knowledge.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the sixth video in this little series I am doing outlining issues with libertarianism. For this, I would like to highlight this article that I saw on the Foundation for Economic Education website, FEE. It's by Kimberly Josephson, and it is called Five Reasons Americans Wrongly See Big Business as the Villain. Our lives have only gotten better as a result of capitalism and the ability to scale, she says. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to read this article, or most of this article, in its entirety. And then I'm going to bring you my new innovation, AA's Blackboard. And we're going to I'm going to outline some of the reasons why it's not as simple as saying capitalism good, big business good, in the way that Kimberly Josephson is trying to do here, at least not in 2021 with all that we've seen. So let us make a start. This is Josephson. She says, "We all aspire for some form of achievement and usually applaud those when it is first obtained. Most recently, the new Wolf on Wall Street, Whitney Wolf Herd, has been heralded in the media as the female CEO making history and a person to aspire to. But entrepreneurs, beware. If you do too well for too long, perceptions of your wealth will likely shift, as our culture tends to position wealth creators as greed mongers. However, it is our greed, not the entrepreneurs, that rewards them with riches. We willingly hand our dollars over for Teslas, iPhones, and Prime deliveries that fulfill all types of needs and desires." I mean, I'll just pause here. Again, I would question whether consumer preferences are really what has driven the wealth of Elon Musk, for example. It's true that Amazon and Apple have got popular consumer devices, but in the case of Tesla, I wonder how much of that is driven by Wall Street rather than by the average punter on the street. Anyway, let's continue. "As such, we should be thanking businesses for the options they have provided, not giving producers guilt trips for the voluntary exchanges that they have enabled." So, I mean, just before we go on, I mean, if all Apple did was make iPhones, or if all Amazon did was sell products at a competitive market rate, I don't think anybody would be objecting, but they don't. They go more than they go a step further, don't they? They try to push a vision of the world onto everyone else, and they increasingly get bolshy with their demands for how the world should look. So she's leaving out a key part of why so many people have turned against big business. It's not just because people think that Tim Cook or Mark Zuckerberg or Jeff Bezos are greedy. It's because they are increasingly behaving like tyrants. So anyway, let's continue. "So here are some contradictory reasons why we shun those who have profited the most from their success and why we should change the negative narrative. One," she says, "we like the underdog, but not the fat cat. We often celebrate and praise local businesses with shop small slogans, but if that small shop happens to develop into a franchise or to attract big investors, our perceptions seem to change. Think of all those bands we label as sellouts for, well, making sales. The presence of sustainable profits shouldn't negate all the hard ground work it took for that entrepreneur to get things going, from unfortunate circumstances such as John Paul Mitchell's rag to riches to endless trials to get the product right, such as James Dyson's 1,127 prototypes for the first bagless vacuum. Any large business was once the small shop, and its growth is a testament that it did something right." Yes, Josephson, correct. But what this is ignoring is the transition that I have talked about from the entrepreneurial business driven by somebody with drive and vision and passion, let's say for cars, in the case of Henry Ford, or for cartoons, and for theme parks, in the case of Walt Disney, or you know, vacuum cleaners, in the case of James Dyson, or any other entrepreneur you care to name, and the transition that those businesses take from being private businesses to IPOs that are then that then become public companies on the stock market, when the entrepreneur dies and when the company is taken over by managerial elites. I mean, she used the example of the iPhone. The visionary, Steve Jobs, is, you know, he's dead and gone. It is now being taken over by a professional manager, Tim Cook, who is unmistakably a member of the managerial elite. The same thing happened with Google, famously, when Sergey Brin and Larry Page gave way to the likes of Eric Schmidt and Susan Wojcicki. And the same thing happened. I mean, we could talk about the likes of Michael Eisner and various other executives who've come into, you know, Disney. It's a long way from the vision of Walt Disney at this point. And we can, I mean, you could pick any company you want, and they go through that. They go through that process. So it's a little bit disingenuous to always go back to the rags to riches story, because what happens to a company after the original entrepreneur is dead and gone or retires and the company is given over to the professional management class? That vision and drive and sense of family values and so on and hard work, they often and frequently get pushed aside in favor of kind of corporate values, whatever they happen to be. And increasingly, of course, in 2021, that comes packaged with a woke agenda, doesn't it? So it's not enough just to appeal to the rags to riches story of the entrepreneur. So, you know, I give Josephson naught out of 10 here, because she's not dealing with the chief problem that people have. People don't resent or have a problem with the successful entrepreneur. What they have a problem with is companies who go far beyond their original remit. Shut up, brand, and sell me cars or sell me chocolate bars or whatever it happens to be. Don't try to push anything else on me, your politics, for example. Josephson just ignores that point. So, yes, let us move on. Number two, we fail to realize that big businesses can be good for small businesses. During the 2021 Super Bowl, DoorDash tugged at our heartstrings, while Uber Eats took a direct approach in calling for the support of local restaurants. And although these ads are self-serving, that's okay. Our local support fuels their big businesses and vice versa. In fact, many small businesses source from and leverage large corporations, and as such, small firms can have a powerful influence on the larger players. Can they now? Can they? Well, let's see. Let's pretend that all of the small and medium firms that source a massive corporation like General Motors or Ford or Coca-Cola or Pepsi or Unilever, you know, let's pretend they all decided to get together and say, well, look, we've had enough of this woke agenda you're trying to push on us, massive corporation, and we're going to withhold our business from you until you know, you stop doing this. Do you think they'd listen, or do you think they just simply reroute and find new suppliers? So it's a little bit disingenuous to say that they have a powerful influence on the larger players. Also, this overlooks a lot of the pressures that come the other way. You know, I've looked on this channel before at the relationship between some of the large supermarkets in this country and the farmers, Tesco's and Sainsbury's, for example. Tesco's especially are famous for leveraging their massive economies of scale often the only purchaser for various farms. They essentially have many of these small suppliers over a barrel and get to set their price. So when Tesco's want to reduce, the price of items on the shelf, they lean on their suppliers to reduce the wholesale price. And many times the small supplier has no negotiation power. So I think it's disingenuous to ignore these things in this article from Fee. She says the wonderful thing about a market economy is the derived demand it generates and the supporting industries it can invigorate. Many small towns house big businesses, and Forbes' list of America's best largest employers features several firms with small town roots, providing employment opportunities that can lead to individual advancement. I mean, notice the sleight of hand that happened there, where she said many of the biggest firms started out, you know, they had small town roots. What does that mean to any of those small towns that are still there? I mean, oh yeah, great, the original McDonald's was here. Who cares? So I don't think that this is a particularly good argument. The first paragraph and the second paragraph do not address any of the major issues that anybody from a small business would have. I mean, she wrote this article in 4 days ago, March 20th, 2021. What's the number one gripe that a small business would have with a big business in 2021? It's the fact that the government shut down the small business while keeping the big businesses open, propping up the big business, leaning on the small business and shutting them down for the lockdown, both in Britain and in vast swathes of America, especially those areas with Democrat governors. So, yes, she didn't mention that. She didn't mention the enormous lobbying power that big business has that small businesses do not. So, I'm giving this article a 0 out of 10 so far. And don't forget, I'm somebody with free market sensibilities and leanings. You know, I'm into Austrian economics. And yet, I come across this article and I'm thinking, I don't want to be on the same side as this woman. So anyway, let's carry on. Number three, Hollywood distorts reality while raking in riches. The villainizing of venture capitalists is a common practice in films and TV series, with billionaire Batman as an exception. The media portrays CEOs as being abhorrent and corrupted by their money. But this seems rather paradoxical, given that these tycoon tyrants are played by millionaire and billionaire actors who have traditionally gone unscathed for their wealth, despite their more than questionable moral standards. Okay, well, I'm with you there. Let's question the moral standards of Hollywood. Good that she's picked up on this. But this is just whataboutism, isn't it? It's not really addressing any serious point that anyone would have with big business in 2021. It's just kind of going for a bit of low-hanging fruit elsewhere. So, again, a 0 out of 10 argument here. Look, who cares? Hollywood lie about everything. Of course they're going to lie about venture capitalists as well. Who gives a shit? Unlike how it is portrayed in the movies, the market is not a zero-sum game, and the rich don't profit from people being poor. Actually, many who are rich give back quite a lot. And now, I don't know what's through that link, and I'm not going to click on it here, but that's something else that people really need to question. I mentioned Henry Ford earlier on. Now, he set up something called the Henry Ford Foundation, or he left a bunch of money. I'm not sure how the Ford Foundation got going. But this is the idea of the rich giving back. I mean, let's have a look what sort of activities the Ford Foundation fund, or any of the other large charity. I mean, let's look at Bill Gates and what non-government organizations under the guise of charity is he funding? How much of that money ends up in the open society, NGO list, for example? How much of it goes to agitating, against foreign governments abroad in the name of this, that, or the other? How much of it goes to, pro-choice groups? How much of it goes to the Democrat Party or to the Republicans, for that matter? You know, how much of this, giving back quite a lot, how much of it is genuine charity and how much of it is activism in the name of charity? And again, if Joseph Sum was honest and if she was writing a genuine article, she tried to address some of these points, some of these serious problems that people have with big business in 2021. Let us continue. This is a terrible advertisement for Fee, one of the venerable old libertarian think tanks and organizations out there, many, many good books and articles over the years. But this is the sort of thing they're putting out at the moment. Is this going to resonate with anyone at all who's been paying attention? Four, we think big businesses can't be beat. Suppose monopolies don't last long in a competitive market, given that entrepreneurs play offense, resulting in industry leaders being constantly challenged. Michael Porter attests that substitutions are ever present but easy to overlook, since it differs from the industry's leading offering. But eventually new entrants will steal the spotlight, much like how esports is attracting players and investors at an impressive rate and is predicted to surpass traditional sports. Many of the top firms of yesteryear are only namesakes today, and at present invites to Clubhouse are making Facebook notifications look quite dated. Disruptions can and do happen if entry costs and regulations are manageable. Entrepreneurs leverage indirect forms of competition and launch not only innovations, but substitutions. Kodak is still trying to make a comeback from phones replacing cameras. Now, again, I understand this argument. I've made this argument myself in the past. But it doesn't address the root of the issue with the monopolies themselves. Why is it, okay, that when I tried to boycott P&G after their horrendous Gillette ad, that I found it virtually impossible because the top three brands in that category are all owned by P&G? Why is it that General Motors has gone bust four times and yet is still in operation? How do all these companies keep on going? It's because they are backed by the state, aren't they? Kimberly, you've left that fact out. You've left out the very cozy relationship that the Facebooks and the Apples have with the current government in America. You've left out the extremely cozy relationship that those automobile manufacturers have had with the government going back to the 1930s. It's disingenuous to leave out that detail because it's part of the root cause of why these monopolies exist. They're not necessarily what they would call efficiency monopolies, are they? They're state-backed, state-induced monopolies. And so even the natural disruptive power of the market and the innovation that comes in, they're able to keep it at bay through backing various bits of regulation, which I'll get onto in a second. It's interesting to look at their incentives for supporting regulation, and we'll get into that when I get to the blackboard. Number five, concentrated wealth and power makes us uncomfortable. I mean, it's not just uncomfortable. It's not just uncomfortable, is it? It's not just making us uncomfortable. It's affecting us because they're trying to destroy our culture. It's not just uncomfortable. It's an existential threat to everything we've known. But, she says, in due time, even the biggest firms can become vulnerable or go bust in a free market economy. Yeah, okay. It's theoretical, but the fact that Blockbuster exists, okay, or the fact that, you can point to any major company in the past that's now, either gone out of business or they're no longer a market player. You can point to AOL or, some what pick your any example, AMP, whatever it happens to be, okay? But Coca-Cola, Pepsi, Unilever, Facebook, Apple, Google aren't all going to go bust, are they? Ford, General Motors, you know, you go down, the entire Fortune 500 is not going to go bust. One or two of those companies may go, but not all of them. And when they're all singing from the same hymn sheet and affecting our culture on the level that they are, this argument's not going to get anywhere. You know, when they're all on the same side, it becomes a problem. Especially when they use monopolistic tactics to keep out new competitors. You know, when My Pillow is getting their card processing capabilities pulled from them, when new entrants to the market are being kept out of the market through cartel-like behavior, when Gab is trying to provide an alternative platform to Twitter and he's had 5 bank accounts shut, this is not the market in operation, is it, Kimberly? But you're not addressing any of those things, which are at the root of why so many people reading this article are turning against big business. So these arguments are landing on deaf ears, aren't they? Because they're not addressing what's actually been going on in the world for the past 5, 10, 20 years. Although the reins on some public sectors are loosening, such as NASA welcoming competition, others are tightening or showing no signs of ever shifting. Think back to F.A. Hayek's criticism of the monopolization of money. If we are concerned with a firm being in control of too much of a market offering, we should be more concerned of the concentration of power wielding control over entire industries. But even the public sector can't stop private competition from providing alternatives, from cryptocurrencies challenging fiat dollars to next day deliveries speeding past the USPs. Yes, but what I'm saying is that needs to happen across the board, and it's not going to, is it? I mean, just saying, I mean, we're at the point where these companies are so big that they can make decisions that piss off half of their customer base and it just doesn't even matter to them. They can make a loss and it just doesn't matter. Most of them do turn a loss because they're answerable ultimately to shareholders, and Wall Street does its own thing. It has a different set of metrics and indicators that it looks at. So it's not even about whether the man on the street is buying the product or not. Some of these biggest companies we've heard of are, you know, valued at billions of dollars who've never turned a profit. Anyway, let's carry on. Our lives have only benefited from capitalism and those who harness the power of profit, given the ability to scale. Profits can help support and grow an organization and serve as a buffer when times get tough. This is why many non-profits are struggling to sustain themselves, given hardships caused by COVID-19, and why the change for shared value is gaining traction, since business solutions can serve as social solutions if meeting a need while making a profit. Well, I mean, you assume they make a profit. It's not always the case. Ludwig von Mises noted that there is no Western capitalistic country in which the conditions of the masses have not improved in an unprecedented way. And this is because entrepreneurs pivot according to economic contingencies. So let them pivot and let us praise them for it and profit from it. Within the US, each generation has fared better than the last thanks to technological advancements. So I'll just pause again before I get to my blackboard. How many people watching this video are in their 30s or in their 20s or even in their late teens, okay? And I've seen the demographics of this channel, and most of the viewers are younger than 35, and a huge bulk of viewers are in their 20s. I ask you, do you feel that you are better off than previous generations? You let me know in the show notes if you genuinely feel that you're better off than your parents and your grandparents were. Do you feel like you live in a materially better off society, in a safer society, in a society that, you know, feels like it has a hopeful future? Tell me that, because when Ludwig von Mises noted that back in 1949 when he was writing, it was true, absolutely true. But this is 70 years since then. Is it still true now? Well, you tell me. You have the experience of being a young person at this time. They've got access to better ideas and resources. Better ideas? Really, Kimberly? Ideas like what? Ideas like white people are at the root of all evil? Ideas like, you know, there's no real distinction between the genders and that, you know, a man can be a woman and a woman can be a man, no problem. Better ideas like that? Which better ideas do you have in mind? And despite unforeseen hardships and externalities, the profit motive has promoted progress in an unimaginable way. Progress, yeah. And talent continues to emerge. And such talent should serve as inspiration and nothing less. And that's how she ends the article.
By Foundations of Writing on the Academic Agency. To write clearly will help you to think clearly. The ability to communicate ideas in lucid prose is foundational to success in many areas, and it is a basic requirement in every walk of life. You will learn the parts of speech and come to understand the core functions of the English language, sentence construction and syntax, punctuation, style, and common mistakes. Once you see how mistakes are made, you will not unsee them. You will know for the rest of your life. Foundations of Writing. Buy it now.
So, hopefully you can see some of the problems with this already, but let me begin my blackboard breakdown. So what I've done here on the blackboard is I've made three columns: what libertarians want, what big businesses want, and what government wants. Okay, and this is why I have titled this video, "Are Libertarians the Useful Idiots of Big Business?" Okay. Libertarians want deregulation. Big business, on the other hand, actually welcome regulations because they are the ones who have vast compliance departments, people actually whose interest and job it is to welcome in and implement new regulations. Okay. They also have the resources and the reserves to be able to make the capital investments to meet the new regulatory barrier. So regulations are very good for big business because they actually help to pull the ladder up. They help to make it harder for new entrants to the market. So big business will always welcome regulations. I mean, take the situation with the social media now. Let's imagine that Congress bring in a whole new raft of regulations. Google and Facebook Twitter, they probably have the financial backing and the reserves to be able to deal with whatever new regulations are brought in. Could Gab comply with them? You know, does the chap running that with his tiny staff have the capability to deal with whatever Congress throw at him? Especially given that those regulations are probably going to be co-written by his competitors. I mean, that's just one market, but, you know, one industry. But that's how it is across the board. You know, all of these lobby groups, they welcome the regulations because they're invited to sit on consultation meetings and they end up writing them. So obviously government want to regulate more. Big business wants to regulate more. So government and big business have aligned incentives. And libertarians, well, they want deregulation and they don't get that. Except in an area which I'm about to get to in a second. Libertarians are against cronyism. That's big business and government working together. But big business, they give donations to lobby government. And the government are answerable to those donors. So, and they like the money that they get from those donors. and big business get more of a say in what goes on, you know, the more of those donations they give, and they get special favors from the government. So, I mean, it's all well and good libertarians being against cronyism, but they're never going to get their way on that one. So big business doesn't care what libertarians say, and neither does the government. So they can argue against cronyism all day long. It still happens. Third, libertarians want a smaller state. Well, big business wants a bigger state, because the bigger the state, you know, don't forget, the state always gives big business a leg up. You know, not only are they donors, but they're also massive employers most of the time. And so there's an incentive for any government, because they want to look good on paper, you know, unemployment's gone up under me. They've got a permanent incentive to try to, you know, give a leg up to the big business whenever they can. So, of course, the big business supports a bigger state and the government supports a bigger state. Because the big business and the state are just two heads of the same beast. Libertarians still haven't learned that lesson, apparently. Four, libertarians want lower taxes. Well, big business wants lower taxes too. But here's the counterintuitive point. The government also wants lower taxes because they're popular. And they can sell that. You know, when was the last time any Western government tried to balance the books? By, you know, trying to bring in more, you know, trying to raise taxes to bring in more money that way while lowering spending. They don't do that. That they'll increase spending and they'll lower taxes at the same time, as Trump did. You know, so the government does not always have... The government has actually incentive to lower taxes, or at least to be seen to lower taxes. So this is one where the libertarians are in line with what the big business and the government wants, and this is one of the areas where they can be, you know, useful idiots, you know, and... perhaps it's even popular. This is the one area where it's fairly popular with most people. Nobody wants to pay more taxes, right? Fifth, libertarians support private property. Well, big business, they support private property to the extent that it gives them nominal independence for their own activities. You know, ideally, Mark Zuckerberg does not want any kind of third-party oversight of where he's sticking his money. Does he? Of what activities he's funding. How he's getting involved in local and national politics. And he's just one example. There are dozens of these billionaires getting involved all over the place, all through history. But especially in American history. So yeah, big business supports private property too. But what big business means by private property is that the sphere to be able to influence stuff without anybody looking over their shoulder. They're not just thinking of somebody owning their own house and painting their own fence and mowing their own garden. They're thinking of a lack of accountability for their interference in social and political affairs. And their ability to hide their, you know, assets in various interesting and cunning ways. And the government, of course, now this is also where I think a lot of libertarians are stuck in a kind of old-fashioned paradigm where they imagine the state and the government want to increase their powers, right, to nationalize things or to bring more things in the direct control of the state. That's not the case. And I'll explain why in a moment. The government actually wants to get key functions off the books and into the hands of big business. The more key stuff they can get into the hands of big business, the less accountable the government are for it. You see? And I'll talk about that in a moment. And let's just finish off the list. Finally, libertarians support personal freedom. Whereas big business, of course, they support the woke agenda, which is a kind of personal freedom. You know, it's the freedom to have a sex change, the freedom to have an abortion, the freedom to you know, take part in a gay pride, the freedom to teach critical race theory, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's a type of freedom that they are pushing. Not necessarily the kind of negative liberty that the libertarians are pushing for, but it's still predicated on a kind of personal freedom. The freedom to smoke weed, for example, would be something that all of these guys would agree with. The freedom to watch porn, the freedom to do all of those kind of degenerate things that you're used to doing. And of course, big business supports all of those things because, it makes a more compliant customer base, doesn't it? The more of these vices you can get people addicted to, the more money you can extract from them to do various things. And then, of course, the government support the woke agenda. And when I say the government, it doesn't matter if it's Tory or Labour or Republican or Democrat. They all support all of this rubbish. The only part of the American system that doesn't are the ones who are still being, you know, loyal to the former 45th president. But there's still a battle for control over the GOP there, and the instincts of a lot of the old kind of Bush era guys is actually when push comes to shove, they're with the wokesters and against the populace. We've seen that. You've seen Mitt Romney march with BLM. You've seen Mitch McConnell, you know, prostrate himself in front of Harris and Biden, etc. So, if you have a think about what is it that libertarians actually get, what is it that they ever achieve to the extent they achieve anything at all, they never get any of the first three things, right? They never get the smaller state, they never get a decrease in cronyism, and they never really get the full suite of deregulation they want. They only ever achieve this, what I've circled here. Libertarians only ever get wins in this zone. Okay? Lower taxes, maintenance of private property for massive corporations. Note, increasingly, the private property of the citizen doesn't really matter. We're seeing an unprecedented attack on, the private sphere of the individual in the pandemic in both Britain and America. In Britain yesterday, or was it earlier today, the mayoral candidate, Lawrence Fox, had a policeman knock at his front door, breaking COVID restrictions with his campaigning materials. You know, you've got the police, you know, knocking on the door on behalf of the current mayor to one of his political rivals. That is private property that the police knocked on his door. In America, you will see increasing attacks on the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. So, and you're also seeing an attack on private property in the individual sphere by big business itself. Think of the whole subscription model thing. I mean, I can just tell you an anecdotal one that happened to me the other day. I got one of these Amazon Music accounts where I've programmed, I don't really use it myself, but I've got nursery rhymes programmed for AAA on there, and I took hours to I've made 8 different playlists along different themes. And I started one up, and one of them starts with the song Animal Fair. I went to the Animal Fair, the birds and the bees are there. And didn't come on. Skipped that, and I went on to Amazon. I'm like, what happened to that? Gone. Disappeared from Amazon Unlimited Music, whatever it's called. Just gone. So there's an example of where, well, I didn't really own that song. I got used to having it, but at the capricious whim of the vendor, it was taken away from me. And it really brought home that, if you're relying on any of this, I mean, I don't rely it for my own music. I've got my own downloads and my old CDs and all the rest of it. But, you know, if I was relying on that, well, now my favorite song is gone. And sooner or later, Amazon decide, well, yeah, this old song from the 1970s is problematic. Needs to be censored. I mean, Disney did it the other day. They took down Dumbo. They literally took Dumbo off their list of classic films on their Disney Plus channel. So now, if you're a Disney Plus subscriber, you thought you were getting the entire Disney catalog. Now one of the major films, Dumbo, last I checked, is unavailable because it contains offensive racial stereotypes. So anyway, private property in the individual sphere is under attack, but when it comes to the big corporates, it's massively defended. And you saw this defense used a lot when Twitter banned Donald Trump. All of the lefties came out and said, well, it's private property. He can do what he wants in his private property. Finally, personal freedom. Yeah. And of course, in this sphere, you know, if libertarians want to campaign for weed or porn or the right to, or, you know, the right to lower the age of consent or any of these other sorts of things, they'll get their way. They'll win victories in that sphere. And it will make people like the British happy. So, yeah, let us continue. Why does government want to put key functions into the hands of big business? Well, first of all, because it maintains regulatory oversight of big business without any of the headaches of organization or any of the costs. It's actually fantastic for the government to get something that they were formerly responsible for off the books. You saw it in this country. Like, they were so relieved to get rid of, like, the post office and Royal Mail and British Rail and British Gas and all of these kind of lumbering, you know, relics of the 1970s. You know, when they were privatized, they were happy to let private hands, you know, take that over. If anything goes wrong, of course, the government can shift and blame the greedy businesses and also localize the evil in particular people or organizations. Oh, it was this business. It was this CEO. It was this particular person who did it. It wasn't our fault, Gov. It was them. So it's fantastic. They maintain oversight, but they don't have to deal with any of the kind of day-to-day, you know, difficulties that go along with it. And, of course, it ensures the long-term survival of key donor classes. You know, if we take the example of the rail situation, in order to operate on those rail lines, they need to win a contract from the government. You know, state-backed. It's basically a state-backed monopoly, but you win the right to run the line. Well, if Richard Branson wants to run his Virgin train down there, you know, maybe the Labour Party or the Tory Party might like a little backhander from Richard Branson for the right to do so. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of it's a no-brainer. And for me, I think this is the key lesson of that the state or the government. I mean, the state and the government aren't the same thing. But I think the operators in and around government kind of learned this from the Reagan years and the Thatcher years, and it was perfected under Clinton, George Bush, and Tony Blair, what we now call neoliberalism. New Labour in this country privatized so many things, but they didn't privatize it by laying it open to the whims of the market. They did it in this way where it's like, well, it's heavily regulated, it's a government contract, but rather than us deal with a headache, we're going to pay this hospital to do it instead. Or, you know, in America, you get the private prisons. You know, rather than the state run this prison, we'll contract it out. So this is how they manage to kind of outsource functions of the state to private businesses. without truly losing control over it, if that makes any sense. And this is really how this almost like fascist neoliberal state has emerged a very good example actually is Peter Thiel's company. If you want to look into that, look into how Peter Thiel makes his money. You know, he's a big defense contractor. His only client is really the US government. How many firms, look at the relationship between the governments now and all the big pharmaceuticals. Big Pharma is in bed with the government. And obviously the pandemic has made that obvious. So, it's superficially different entity, and it means it's technically not on the government's books, but ultimately this is the same class of people, just across, you know, just technically on paper, it's not part of the state. So it's kind of clever. It's kind of clever move that they've done. Hope people can see it. Why would big business want to take on these government functions? I'll outline some more reasons. Number one, they gain power without accountability. So we saw the government's reasons. These are big businesses' reasons now. They gain power without accountability. And number two, hugely increased influence in the direction of life for privileged minorities to push their political and social agendas. Massively more influential now. They'll call it something like, oh, well, let's have a consultation. Let's have a consultation with this business or that business, and we'll go through the guidelines. But then they implement it. I mean, how often have you seen YouTube or Facebook or Twitter act as a proxy for the government in the past year? And when I say the government, I don't mean the former president. I mean all the rest of the parts of the state. Or in the British case, I mean, just the government. They're in lockstep with the government 100% of the way on all issues. So the idea there's a distinction between these, you know, the big business and the government is nonsensical to me in 2021. It's just a kind of outsourced facility. And again, I think the pandemic makes it obvious. Look how quickly the supermarkets got all of their mask paraphernalia up and running. The little arrows on the floor. All of the government mandated stickers. Of course, they can do it quickly. Because it's almost like a kind of... They're so big that they might as well be. They might as well be another wing of the government at this point. And functionally, I would argue they are. Technically, they're not on the books. Third, they can work successively to disenfranchise the majority group. And that, of course, is the woke agenda. And also this other thing I was talking about, you know, you will own nothing and you will like it. The perpetual rent model that they're trying to push in many different spheres of life now. It's both of these things. So, yeah, lots of advantages for big business. As long as liberal democracy persists as our system, oligarchs will rule because, number one, if merchants are not held in check by warriors and priests, they can use their resources to persuade and to trick the masses into serving their interests to their own detriment and even eventual destruction. And I mean the eventual destruction and detriment of the majority population, of the masses. Okay, but liberal democracy is a system of mass persuasion. Well, who's good at mass persuasion? It's, you know, companies with massive PR wings and advertising budgets and marketing campaigns. They've got the ways and the means to do it. They alone have the resources and the powers of persuasion necessary to sway the mass man. And if you doubt that, if you doubt that they have this power, have a look next time you're out how many people are wearing masks out in the street. Have a look how many people, if you're here in Britain, have got We Love the NHS stickers in their front window. Let alone looking at the sales of all of the top brands. So, yes, it's a persuasion game when it comes to liberal democracy. And what that actually does, it doesn't give power to the mass man. It concentrates power into those who have the resources to sway the mass man. That is why liberal democracy is favoured by the merchants, because they can use all of their powers and tricks and their resources to get one over on all of the other power classes. And it's very successful. If you doubt it, I mean, just look at how many people still support NFL games and you name it. Look how many people go on LinkedIn, right? Here's my challenge to you, right? If you work in a kind of corporate career, just have a little lurk on LinkedIn and read some of the absolute rubbish that people post on their LinkedIn profiles in 2021. People do comply with the social pressure that's put on them, even if the ideas are totally absurd. And even if the ideas lead directly to the destruction of everything you love. Whatever the theoretical wishes of libertarianism, its practical political effects are to empower the merchant class. At root, the question you must ask yourself is this: whether the state of affairs in which we are ruled over by the merchant class is preferable to rule by any of the other classes, okay? So what's the alternatives? I've laid out the problems and we all know about these problems. What are the alternatives? Well, we could be ruled over by the priest class, by the warrior class, whatever that means in 2021, but, you know, the military, the class of the mass man, the class of outcasts, or just a foreign power. Just accept a foreign power comes and invades. That's another kind of possibility, right? If we have a little assessment, there are no alternatives to this other than in utopian dreams. So you may be thinking, well, why does it have to be one of these? Why can't it be something else? I'm an ANCAP. I dream of the end of the state. Not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. It's a utopian dream. It's as unlikely to happen as the communist utopia that bottom left people dream about, where everybody's an artist and nobody's starving. Not going to happen. And even if it did happen, right? Even if you somehow brought about the ANCAP utopia, you'd still be ruled over by there would still be a hierarchy there, and it would probably be the car king that I've talked about before. So you'd still be ruled over by a type of merchant in that society. There is no escaping it. There has to be a group on top. The question is which group and what benefits and drawbacks do each bring. That is the question that you should be asking in your kind of theoretical way of thinking at the moment, I think. That's the realistic assessment, because it's not going to be any of these kind of utopian ones. Number one, the current merchant class is allied both to the class of the outcasts and to foreign interests. And that is obvious if you think about it. The class of outcasts, which is the intersectional coalition, right? The LGBT, immigrants, people of colour, Muslims, you know, this is the class of outcasts. These are the kind of people who a generation ago were on the fringes of society. They were kind of unwanted and mocked, repressed, you could say, or oppressed, as they argue. But now, you know, now's their time. They're being liberated by the merchant class. So that's the, you know, and they use those as a battering ram against their enemies, as we've seen. Okay, they obviously don't have the interests of those people at heart, but they use them. I mean, I'm talking about the outcasts here. Which particular foreign interests they're in hock to, you know, you can speculate amongst yourselves. This means that, in effect, most of the West is ruled by a cabal of its enemies. I mean, I would argue that we have seen that most of Western civilization is ruled over by people who are actively hostile to it and want to destroy it. Hence, a cabal of its enemies. That is a situation that we face, and that is the situation that has developed with the merchants in charge. Okay. Libertarian think tanks such as Fee still seem to argue as if it is 1950 rather than 2021. It's like they're stuck in this time warp where they're still arguing with John Maynard Keynes back in 1949. Very different time. Many different developments since 1950. This is not to say that the free market principles on a theoretical level that the likes of Mises talked about are not true. What I'm saying is that the reality on the ground and the facts and the events that have happened mean there are more pressing concerns right now with whether we are championing this entrepreneur or that entrepreneur, because certain entrepreneurs are basically trying to ruin everything that we love. And we have to ask why. We have to going to be the challenge of all of our lifetimes. And it's not being helped by articles like this from Fee. This makes them worse than useless in the current year. It makes them an active part of the ruling regime. You know, to me, this article marked Kimberly out, not as an ally. She doesn't seem like a friend to me. She seemed like she was on the side of the enemy. I mean, tell me if you're wrong. Maybe you're watching this and you're a libertarian and you think, well, Kimberly, she sounds more like, you know, the person on my side. And if you feel that, tell me in the notes. Tell me why you disagree with what I've been saying and why you side with her. To me, doesn't seem like she's a friend. Tell me if you think she's a friend. To support big business in 2021 is to support the destruction of your culture and history. It is to support an insane radical agenda hell-bent on destroying Western civilization. And when I say support, I don't actually mean in terms of money, right? Because it's very difficult, like I said, to boycott all of it. I mean, if you boycotted every single big business, you couldn't live, okay? You know, they're so ubiquitous that it's virtually impossible to... if you tried to cut out Unilever and P&G, just those two companies, the amount of products that simply disappear that have no alternative is vast. If you added Pepsi, Coca-Cola, and Amazon, right, to that, especially in lockdown conditions... How are you going to survive? So, you know, I would say there are real practical drawbacks to the idea that you're going to financially squeeze them out. That's very difficult. But what I'm talking about is supporting them intellectually and apologizing for them and coming up with arguments in defense of them, like what this Kimberly is doing here. That shouldn't be what libertarians are doing in 2021, I'm afraid. They should be hammering these big businesses as being the enemies of the free market and the enemies of liberty. That's what they should be doing, but they're not. There are no solutions, only trade-offs. The famous Thomas Sowell line. The trade-off for worldly luxuries, porn, superhero films, and all of the other things that you've enjoyed your whole life is the total destruction of your history and culture and the complete moral subversion of your societies. I don't know if that is a necessary trade-off. I don't know if that will always come if you allow the merchant class to rule. I don't know if it's necessary, but it is, in our contingent reality in 2021, what has happened. This is the evidence that we have from history that they have almost destroyed our culture. Okay? It's got a long way to go yet. There are, you know, it's far from being over in Britain or America or in Europe. Our history is too long and there are too many people who love it, okay? But the damage is massive. And if something is not done within our lifetimes, it will be gone, friends. So this is the trade-off. So yes, you know, we all love our worldly luxuries. I'm as guilty as anyone. Nescafe Gold, ha-ha. But if it's a choice between all of that shit and the Western culture and its history and the preservation of all of those things, you have to ask yourself, well, what ultimately do you want? Is it the porn and the anime and the bloody weed? Or is it those other things that matter? I don't think it's a false dichotomy. I really don't at this point. Second, the trade-off for siding with warriors or the priest class against the merchants is, and this is a fact, a decline in material quality of life and possibly also of technology. It will retard technological innovation, as we've seen in history, in the Chinese example and many other examples. And it will also, you know, there will be things that you enjoy today that you won't, that you wouldn't enjoy if you were ruled over by a military elite or by a priestly elite. That's just obvious. And you can even look at other examples in history. I mean, you know, there is no doubt that the people of Iran would be better off if they were not run by a group of clerics in a material sense. I mean, arguably spiritually too, but you know, that's a separate issue that I don't want to get into here. But in theory, you know, a theocracy could have benefits, right? It could have benefits. So again, these are things that you have to think about. And then third, the trade-off for siding with the mass man over the merchants is that it will likely transition society downwards even further. Or as argued by Plato and many others in history, it would quickly dissolve into a petty tyranny. And I'm afraid to say all of those people who are on the Trump train, who are kind of populists, you know, I remember that, was it the Democracy Party or whatever it was called, the Brexit Party? Yeah, it was the Brexit Party, wasn't it? Most of whom have ended up in the Lords now, I've noticed. But that kind of populist energy would facilitate a transition from the merchants to the mass man. And it's not necessarily a move upwards, right? And the world where Donald Trump crosses the Rubicon, for example, isn't necessarily going to stop the, you know, what we call the acceleration, isn't necessarily going to lead an upwards direction, is it? Not necessarily. So, you know, there's something else to think about. And I think it's a question that populists need to think about, because the populist position is the veneration of the mass man. If you're a populist, you have that in common with Brendan O'Neill, literally a kind of Marxist kind of character. Well, you know, what does it mean for the mass man to take over? Now, you could argue that the masked man is not just one blob, but is made up of, you know, rural peasants, urban workers, artisans, or what you'd call like small business people these days, craftsmen, tradesmen, you know, and then all of the kind of minions of the state, the civil servants, the, you know, there are many different, there are now most of those managers, most of those kind of managerial types, the civil servants, the teachers, the professors and so on, they're in the service, whether wittingly or not, of the merchant class. The managerial elite and the merchant class are kind of as one as things stand. Okay. So that there are careful distinctions you may want to make. I'm painting with the broadest brush here, but it is a question that any populist needs to ask themselves: what would a society led by the masked man look like? All right. So hopefully this video has given you some food for thought. I've just left you with this idea of pick your poison. I don't believe there are any easy answers. I mean, it may well be that when all is said and done, you think about all of the relative costs and trade-offs and pros and cons, and actually maybe rule by the merchants isn't so bad. In which case, go back to Fresh Prince. Go back to your room. Play with your toys and your costumes and forget about all this. All right. So long for now.
Now available at the Academic Agency. Sharpen your analytical mind and your argumentation skills with Foundations of Logic. The course draws on the ancient wisdom of traditional logic that students learned for over 2,000 years, from the time of Aristotle through to the medieval schoolmen, right down to the 20th century. Sign up now for a free preview lecture.
Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.